The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What is real and what is merely a mathematical trick? That seems to me to be the central question, the real heart of these explorations into the meaning of quantum mechanics. I first asked this question, I don't know how many episodes ago. It's been a long time. We've been on this journey for quite a while. And as we explored this question, that once we get quantum mechanics, we start debating, what does quantum mechanics teach us about reality? What is actually going on? Can we describe the physical processes happening in the subatomic world? Or is this all just a series of mathematical tricks and we actually don't know? And we can still get results, but we can't actually derive meaning from it. We saw how this central question led to the major split between the very founders of quantum mechanics, with people like Heisenberg on one side saying it's all mathematical trickery. Don't worry about the details. It's impossible to visualize or explain what's actually happening in subatomic processes. It's impossible to explain how entanglement actually works. It's impossible to explain how quantum jumps actually work. It's impossible to explain how collapse of the wave function actually works. So don't sweat it because it's so far outside of our everyday experience. Just do the math because you get results, right? And on the other side, you have people like Schrodinger saying that we need to focus on the real. Otherwise, we're not understanding subatomic physics. We're just developing a set of tools that allow us to make predictions, but that doesn't lead to any revelation. It doesn't lead to any deeper insight. We just have mechanics. We just have tools for getting the job done without knowing what the job is. And that we need to focus on the real. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now 8 episodes deep into this discussion of quantum mechanics. I want you to know that this is by no means a complete or exhaustive analysis of quantum mechanics. That would take its own Ask a Quantum Mechanic podcast show and several decades of episodes. But I hope that I've provided at least a high-level overview of why quantum mechanics seems so challenging and also fun and also mysterious and also spooky and also complex and also beautiful. There really is a lot of beauty in quantum mechanics. The fundamental postulates that, while breaking everything we know about classical physics in the macroscopic world, are relatively straightforward. Remember that episode? Months ago, we were so young then, we're carefree, we hadn't worried about all these interpretations yet, and we just got to learn about the postulates of quantum mechanics and the actual mathematical underpinnings of the theory that make it so successful, that make it agree with experiment. The math there that those postulates lead into, the math and the actual mathematics of quantum mechanics is actually pretty simple. It's college level mathematics, and the mathematics could even be taught in high school if we wanted to. I know back in the day, Heisenberg's matrix mechanics approach seemed really crazy and out there and unfamiliar. Nowadays, it's standard. Every physicist is trained in linear algebra, in matrix methods. And when you do that, the mechanics of quantum mechanics become second nature. The math, certainly in quantum mechanics, is far easier than the math behind general relativity or quantum field theory. From firsthand experience, I can tell you that the math of quantum mechanics quickly becomes natural and intuitive. And dang it, you can solve a whole lot of problems with it. But when you stare at those equations in those quiet moments, and you get away from the current problem you're trying to solve, the current experiment you're trying to verify, and you just sit there quietly and you stare at the equations stare back at you. And you can't help but wonder, what is real and what is merely a mathematical trick. What does nature actually do? When I write down the measurement operation in quantum mechanics, what's actually happening? When I describe a quantum jump from one energy state to another, what's actually happening? When I write down the equation that describes the entanglement of two particles and their subsequent evolution, what's actually happening? Do we have a grasp on subatomic reality? Or do we just have a series of equations that allow us to solve problems and make predictions? Now, you might be tempted to throw your hands up and say, I don't know, it's not my problem. Paul Dirac, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, did not feature much in this story. He wrote a foundational textbook on quantum mechanics to help teach the next generation. He was definitely part of the Copenhagen school, although he had some pretty cool ideas of his own that we'll explore later. But definitely was a fan of just doing the math. He said, quote, "The interpretation of quantum mechanics has been dealt with by many authors, and I do not want to discuss it here. I want to deal with more fundamental things." Now, that's a pretty sassy approach, if you ask me, saying, oh, the actual interpretation of what is real is somehow less fundamental than the mathematics. And I suppose from a purely mathematical point of view, that's correct. Like, who cares what nature does? We are trying to discover deep truths of logic and reason. And Paul Dirac was a master of mathematical physics, so it's not surprising he said that. Any mathematicians out there in the audience probably agree with the same sentiment. But I'm not a mathematician, okay? I'm a physicist. I do care about what the universe is actually doing. And I don't want just a simple set of rules. I want to know what's going on. I'm curious. How does a quantum jump work? I want to envision it. I want to think about it. I want to feel it. You know, in my soul, what a quantum jump is. And when I stare at those equations, they stare back at me. Maybe we have an escape hatch out of all this. Maybe quantum mechanics isn't correct. Maybe it's simply wrong. But we can't take that escape hatch. Our understanding of quantum mechanics sits behind so much technology in the modern world. Take away experiments and laboratories. The semiconductors in your cell phone that are letting you listen to this episode right now are powered by our knowledge of quantum mechanics. If we did not understand quantum mechanics, then the semiconductor wouldn't work. Lasers wouldn't work. Nuclear power wouldn't work. Literally all of chemistry wouldn't work. If you want to say quantum mechanics is wrong, then you're challenging nuclear power, semiconductors, lasers, and all of chemistry, and more. Something like 25% of the gross domestic product of Europe and North America is driven by our knowledge of quantum mechanics. You can't escape the reality, even though we don't know what the reality is. Despite our best attempts to prove quantum mechanics wrong for over a century, it just keeps showing up like those slow-moving killers in scary movies. You think you've found a way out and a way to hide, and then it just like they just show up. They just don't stop. Run as fast as you want. Quantum mechanics is always going to get you. Okay, so maybe it's not incorrect. Maybe it's just incomplete. Maybe quantum mechanics is missing something. This was Einstein's main point. He said all of quantum mechanics is mathematical trickery. We have the signs of this mathematical trickery with these weird things like uncertainty and probabilities and non-locality in the form of entanglement. These are signs telling us that we do not yet have a fundamental theory of the subatomic world and that we're just not thinking hard enough. And that if we do some more digging, ask the right questions in the right way at the right time, the real truth of quantum mechanics of the subatomic world will reveal itself to us. We'll have quantum mechanics 2.0, and we can put away uncertainty, put away probabilities, Put away the measurement problem. Heck, even put away entanglement. We'll have a deeper, more fundamental theory that will appear sensible and real, and we can talk about it over coffee without sweating. We can rest easy and put this nasty century of quantum mechanics-based thinking behind us. That was Einstein's argument from the very beginning. He said, we're missing something. And so from the very beginning, people tried to find a deeper version of quantum mechanics. Is there something in there, some subatomic process, some thought, some idea, some equation that will take away all the nasty bits of quantum mechanics and replace it with something that we can wrap our minds around and we can describe with words and little diagrams in kindergarten books of what's happening in the subatomic world? Because that is one big thing that quantum mechanics continues to fail at again and again, which is actually describing what's happening. Quantum mechanics is great at saying what happens, but it doesn't say how it happens. In there, it stands alone from every other theory of physics. Every other theory of physics, I can say, this is how it works. Not just here's the result you'll get in your experiment, here's my prediction, but also here's how this process unfolds. Not so with quantum mechanics. So from the very beginning, people tried to find loopholes, shortcuts, new ideas to try to go deeper than quantum mechanics. One of these branches of lines of thinking relied on hidden variables, which we've met before. That what appears to us in our experiments as probabilistic and non-deterministic and non-local and all this could be explained if the subatomic particles of our world actually carried around with them secret information that told them what to do. And if we had access to that secret information, if we could read that secret code, we would reveal a normal universe, but just at a tiny scale. That every particle has a little notes, a list of instructions from headquarters of what to do. And it's because we don't have access to that hidden knowledge that things appear to us to be random and non-local and measurement issues and all the rest. So the quest was on. Instigated by Einstein, who felt like this was a promising direction, saying maybe we should focus on finding more information about the subatomic world. Maybe we need to broaden our thinking beyond Heisenberg and even Schrodinger. Maybe there's more to the story. Maybe this book that we're carrying around called Quantum Mechanics doesn't make sense because we're missing a few chapters. One of the first attempts to go beyond regular quantum mechanics actually started with Louis de Broglie, or de Broglie, if you're feeling like it. You know, the guy that proposed the whole maybe matter has waves 2 idea and really kickstarted the modern quantum movement. He developed the first of what we call these hidden variable theories of quantum mechanics. That underneath all the probabilities and the messiness and uncertainty and non-locality and everything else that gives you a headache about quantum mechanics, deep down there's a very clean, very classical description of nature where everything is deterministic, where you know exactly what the future will bring. You know exactly what happens during the process of measurement. You know exactly what happens when you separate two particles, where we can recover some classical music if we dig deep enough into our death metal tunes. We can find something familiar. De Broglie looked at the wave-particle duality of nature and took a different approach than the standard Copenhagen interpretation. Remember, the Copenhagen interpretation said the wave in wave-particle duality, when it comes to matter, is merely a mathematical trick for calculating probabilities. That the particles were real, particles existed. We just couldn't tell where they were going to go, what they were going to do, until we actually made a measurement. We could give a range of probabilities, like, okay, there's a blob over here of where the particle might be with high degrees of certainty, and a less certain over here, and like almost definitely not over there. And that was the wave function, the Schrodinger wave function. The wave component of matter just tells us where we're going to find matter the next time we look for it. But the wave itself wasn't real. It wasn't a physical object that you could hold in your hand and whisper to at night, you know, and cuddle on a rainy day. The wave is just a mathematical trick. De Broglie said something else. He said that particles exist and are real, and the waves associated with them also exist and are also real. That the waves were a separate entity that evolved in their own right, did their own thing, followed completely, totally deterministic paths, normal classical physical waves, propagating throughout the universe, and doing so according to the Schrodinger equation. The Schrodinger equation says what matter waves do, how they change in time. And so these waves exist, they are real, they evolve, and the waves tell the particles where to go. So you have this idea that there's a particle traveling. In the Copenhagen interpretation, you don't get to know what the particle is doing until you play peekaboo and look for it. Then its wave function collapses and it appears somewhere. In this idea by de Broglie, that electron that is moving, that subatomic particle that is moving, it has a wave associated with it. One particle, one wave. They go together like twins. The wave propagates outward. It has a physical, real existence. And the information in that wave tells the particle where to eventually go. So if we could somehow dig in deeper and understand the evolution of the wave, we would be able to predict where the particle could go. Like, if there's a ship adrift in the ocean and a wave passes by, the wave carries the particle along with it. In this model, everything is deterministic. The waves move as waves are wont to do. They are propagating there, moving there, doing their thing. And then the particles just do what they're told. The waves interact with each other. They propagate, they move forward. And then they're like, all right, particle, you're going to go here and then go over here. Like Google Maps is going to say you're going to take a left here. And then when you reach the second stoplight, you're going to take a right. The waves tell the particles what to do. But the true locations of the particles are hidden from us. We don't get to follow the exact path of the particle until the end of our experiment. This way, the probabilities of quantum mechanics are still maintained because the probabilities are an experimental fact of nature. You can't get around the probabilities. So how do you fold in a purely deterministic way of particles moving, like we see with this idea of de Broglie, and end up with probabilities? The only way to reconcile those two, because those two don't go together, because the waves know what they're doing, and the waves are telling the particles what to do, but then somehow we don't know what the particles are doing. There has to be a conspiracy. De Broglie said that the waves hide the particle motions from us. The waves move around, do their thing, and they tell the particles what to do, but they tell it in secret. It's hidden from our view. It's hidden information. It's a hidden variable where the variable itself is the location of the particle. It's only when the experiment is over and the particle has finally landed somewhere and registered on a detector do we get to reveal that information. That's the only way to make this work. To have both a deterministic set of equations that govern reality, but then also acknowledge the fact that we get probabilities and randomness in our actual experiments. This interpretation of quantum mechanics, even though it sounds like a completely new theory, it truly is an interpretation because it's designed to give all the exact same experimental results as any other interpretation of quantum mechanics, was eventually dropped by de Broglie. And it's hard to tell from the experimental record either he changed his mind and picked up the Copenhagen interpretation because he just thought this was, you know, an idea that sounded good on paper, but once he started fleshing out, couldn't make any sense, or because Niels Bohr bullied him into it. We'll never quite know. Decades later, in the next generation of quantum mechanics, when they came around, was picked up by another physicist, David Bohm. And so this idea has various names. Pilot wave theory, Bohmian mechanics, de Broglie-Bohm theory. And truly, this idea of pilot wave theory or Bohmian mechanics has some nice benefits. For one, it includes Patreon. Patreon.com/PMSutter is your way to not hide how much you like and support the show. You can make it known to the entire world. And I thank you for your support. That's Patreon.com/PMSutter. One of the biggest benefits of pilot wave theory is that there are no actual uncertainties in the universe. Remember, these interpretations of quantum mechanics are deciding about what's real and what's merely a mathematical trick. In the Copenhagen interpretation, it says that the uncertainties are real. This is a fact. This is a feature of our universe. We don't know how it works. Don't ask us that. But it just, uncertainties are real. All right. You can't measure anything precisely. You never know where a particle exactly is going to go. But it happens because it's real. In pilot wave theory, it says, yeah, there are uncertainties in our measurements, but that's very different from reality itself being uncertain. Instead, the uncertainty flows from the fact that the particle's true position is hidden from us, even though it really has a true position. If you had some godlike superpower, you would see a little particle down there doing its little particle-y thing, zigzagging all around, doing whatever the wave is telling it to do. But we don't have those godlike superpowers, and so we're left to do the best we can, which is the appearance of uncertainty, but not the reality of it. That's the big advantage of pilot wave theory. It moves the uncertainties and probabilities that are inherent in quantum mechanics and moves them away from reality into mere mathematical trickery. Because reality is hidden, obscured from us. We're missing those pages in the book of subatomic physics. And if we had access to those pages, we would be able to see a purely deterministic, purely non-probabilistic world, and everything would be sane again. If you listen carefully to the death metal, you can hear a little bit of Bach playing in the background. Another big benefit of pilot wave theory is that there's no measurement problem anymore. Remember, the measurement problem happened when quantum systems evolve one way when we're not looking, the Schrodinger equation, and another when we are, the collapse of the wave function. In pilot wave theory, there's always a wave and always a particle. Both are real objects. The wave doesn't collapse because it's just like a sound wave or a water wave. It just goes from place to place. And the particle is always there, just going from place to place. Every particle has a wave associated with it. There's no collapse of the wave function because the wave is just there. Everywhere where you have a particle, there's also a wave associated with it. And the wave is always telling the particle what to do. And when you start broadening this perspective, it gets really, really fun because you realize that every particle has its own wave associated with it, even the particles inside your body. So the act of measurement is really just all these waves interacting with each other and telling their little particles what to do. And so if we look at that measurement process, what does measurement actually entail? Let's say an electron hits a screen. Well, the wave associated, the pilot wave associated with the electron, interacts with the pilot wave associated with the detector, which interacts with the pilot wave associated with the electrons flowing down the back of the wire up to the screen, which is associated with the waves associated with the photons leaping into my eyeballs and all the waves of all the particles inside my brain. And what happens when quantum mechanical waves meet each other? Well, everybody's favorite word, entanglement. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the most awesome things about physics is that it's like a user manual for the universe. You can literally use it to predict the future. Now humans are a little bit more complicated. Believe it or not, people are more complicated than quantum physics. I am not joking. And life and dealing with people does not come with a user manual. And the next best thing is therapy. I have been using therapy for years. It's such a powerful tool for me to answer life's questions when those questions don't come in the form of physics problems. And I think you will benefit a lot from it too. And that's why I'm proud to have BetterHelp as a sponsor. BetterHelp is the world's largest therapy service. BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. To learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/spaceman. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/spaceman. When you take pilot wave theory and work it out, you address the measurement problem. Sure do. You address the non-determinacy and probabilities. You solve it. But you have to pay a price. And the price you pay is more entanglement. What you end up with isn't just one pilot wave, one wave function for every particle. You end up with a single wave function that gets shared between all particles in the universe. You scale it all the way out, and I mean all the way, you end up with a single wave function that encompasses the entire universe. And that single wave function is just evolving deterministically, constantly interacting with itself, telling all the particles in the universe where to go. There is some master wave that encompasses all of physical reality. And you, if you could find that wave, feel that wave, see that wave, you would see it evolving according to deterministic equations and telling all the little particles what to do. But it appears hidden to us because the waves obscure the locations of the particles. How exactly do the waves obscure the positions of the particles? Well, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves because we don't have an answer for that. If this sounds familiar, you are not the only one. Some people have criticized pilot wave theory as merely many worlds theory with extra steps. Because you end up with entanglement at the end. You end up with universal wave functions at the end. But if you remember, the many worlds interpretation had only waves. And now pilot waves, it's like, it's making things even more complicated because now you're taking the waves that you accept to exist, the same ones that you do in the many worlds interpretation, but now you're adding particles, now you're adding guiding equations, now you're adding all these hidden information. Like, why are you doing so much work? If waves are so critical, why don't you just have waves? But perhaps the biggest headache with pilot wave theory is non-locality. Once you start adding up all these interacting waves together, you get automatic entanglement across the entire universe, which means every particle receives information from every other particle, no matter where it is in the cosmos, which kind of destroys all of physics because what happens in my experiment should stay in my experiment, and what I do here on Earth shouldn't be affected by some random hydrogen atom in the Andromeda Galaxy. Wait. Hold up. Isn't non-locality like a thing? Didn't we already decide that quantum mechanics is non-local? Didn't we talk about that in a previous episode, or am I losing my mind? I have here in my notes to slowly exhale, and so that's exactly what I'm going to do. Life is kind of funny, isn't it? Not necessarily ha-ha funny, but usually more like, huh, funny. Einstein thought that quantum mechanics was incomplete, and that the answer to uncertainties and probabilities and entanglement was some sort of hidden physics that we have yet to uncover. As he expanded his arguments against quantum mechanics over the decades, he realized that the ultimate expression of quantum mechanics dysfunction was the idea of entanglement, that one quantum system could affect another one regardless of distance. That was his big issue. He's like, look, quantum mechanics is non-local. We got a problem here. This is a symptom of a deeper disease that you have a broken theory, a toxic theory. Working off of Einstein's line of thinking that quantum mechanics is incomplete, that there's more to the story, that maybe there is hidden information, de Broglie and eventually David Bohm would develop a version of quantum mechanics that relies on hidden information, namely the precise location of the particles is hidden from us. They developed this as a way to support Einstein's thinking. He's like, yeah, you're right. You're right, Einstein. Quantum mechanics is incomplete. We think there's more to the story. We think there's deeper hidden information. And they developed pilot wave theory or Bohmian mechanics, however you want to refer to it, along those lines. But as the theory developed, it was realized that the only way to make this idea work was if everything was entangled all the time. And so the one theory that had a promising start of realizing Einstein's dream turned into his nightmare. Einstein didn't like the probabilities and then over time realized that the bigger issue was entanglement and non-locality. People developed a solution to quantum mechanics that avoided probabilities, gave us back a deterministic universe, but had to pay a price, which was even more non-locality. Like I said, funny. You've heard me correctly. One of the main criticisms of pilot wave theory is that it leads to non-locality. But non-locality appears to be baked into quantum mechanics. Trust me, we've tried really, 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 really hard to get around non-locality and we just can't. So what's the beef? Why does regular Copenhagen interpretation quantum mechanics get to have non-locality and everyone shrugs and say, I guess non-locality is a thing, even though we can't explain how it works, but it's here. But then pilot wave theory gives us non-locality and all of a sudden it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Slow down there, Tiger. You got a whole lot of non-locality going on there. Why is this a criticism? The criticism here is that pilot wave theory is a little too non-local. Sure, we can start to get comfortable or at least used to the idea of entangled spin states or other abstract quantum ideas, but with pilot wave theory, we're now entangling positions of particles, which seems off. As in, a hydrogen atom in the Andromeda galaxy isn't just quantum mechanically vaguely entangled with me, but it's literally entangled with me in a very real way. As in, the motion of that hydrogen atom in the Andromeda galaxy literally changes the positions of the atoms inside of my body. Not just spin states, not just polarization, not just some other, you know, random quantum mechanical weird abstract state that actually no one really cares about except quantum physicists. We're talking about entanglement of position, of movement, of location, where when I move furniture around my room and I'm shoving on that couch, I am somehow directly influencing the behavior of atoms throughout the cosmos instantaneously with no communication, no force applied. That's a lot to swallow. It's okay for physicists. I think over the past 100 years, we've gotten used to the idea of entangling spin states and polarization, but entangling position, movement, location, that seems to break like fundamental concepts of like conservation of momentum. How can I be sure? Like if I say I'm going target practice, and I shoot and it misses. And they're like, oh, you miss. I said, no, you don't understand. The movement of the bullet that I shot was entangled with a supernova that went off 4 billion years ago. And because in pilot wave theory, the positions of these particles are entangled, there was actually a non-local influence that happened instantaneously. Nobody's going to buy that. Why? Because It goes back to Einstein's main criticism. How are we supposed to have a sensible theory of physics? How are we supposed to have a consciousness where the movement and choices I make somehow depend on calculating all the entangled properties of the entire universe? Like, how can anything be local? There are other criticisms. Pilot wave theory says that position is a hidden variable, but not momentum, not velocity. But we know from special relativity that position and momentum are on equal footing. You know, space and time are connected. Why should position be singled out but not momentum? Why is position the hidden variable and not the momentum of the particle? So there isn't really a reconciliation between pilot wave theory and special relativity. That means there isn't a relativistic version of pilot wave theory. Copenhagen interpretation, normal, vanilla, quantum mechanics, we have a version of that that is compatible with special relativity. We call it quantum field theory. We do not have a version of that in the language of pilot wave theory. And, you know, good old Newton, equal and opposite forces. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You know, that seems pretty familiar. That has stood the test of time for like 400 years. We have never found a single violation of this principle. In fact, it's encoded now in our conservation of momentum. But here we have in pilot wave theory, the waves tell the particles what to do, but the particles don't tell the waves what to do. How does that influence only flow in one direction? So you come up with things in pilot wave theory that don't make sense. Like, how do these pilot waves actually do the job of hiding the particle positions from us? Why do they single out the position and not the momentum of the particles? Why do the waves act on the particles, but the particles not act on the waves? Yes, if you want to say these waves are real and actual physical objects in our universe, well, where are they? Can I isolate them? Can I manipulate them? Can I study them in isolation without their attendant particles? How does this link actually work? If you want to say they're real, how are they real? It seems like you just end up in the same kinds of questions that you end up with in the Copenhagen interpretation. In the many worlds theory, these ideas sound great, but then they run into problems when you try to describe how it's all supposed to work. Now, none of these are necessarily deal breakers. There could be a relativistic version of pilot wave mechanics out there that we just haven't figured out yet. With a little bit more thought and thinking, we could figure out how the waves act on the particles, but not the reverse. We could figure out how the waves single out the position of the particles to be special, not their momenta. Like, we could do this. We could end up saying, yeah, positions of particles throughout the universe are entangled with each other and operate on each other instantaneously. We could figure out how that works, but we haven't. And so we're left with a bad taste in our mouths. But we're also left with a bad taste in our mouth from the Copenhagen interpretation and the many worlds interpretation and honestly every interpretation. Like any of the criticisms of any of the interpretations, that's about the long and short of it. There's some aspect of the interpretation that just seems funky. And you're left pointing to one or more statements and you just say, how is this supposed to work? When I look at the Copenhagen interpretation, I say, well, how is measurement actually operating? When I look at many worlds, I say, how does the splitting of the universe actually happen? When I look at pilot waves, I say, how do the waves actually hide the information about the location of the particles? How? If you want to say this is real and not just a mere mathematical trick, you need to explain how it works. And all the interpretations come up short. And all of the interpretations, every single one that we visited so far, Copenhagen, many worlds, pilot wave, all end up falling into Einstein's trap. All of them end up involving entanglement. All of them end up involving non-locality. Every single one. If there's anything we've learned from quantum mechanics, is that non-locality appears to be a thing, because every interpretation that we have met involves some form of non-locality. And that's what Einstein despised the most about quantum mechanics. So again, I ask, what is real and what's just a mere mathematical trick? What does quantum mechanics actually teach us about reality? We have all these interpretations. We've met three of them. We're going to meet some more. But in the spirit of quantum mechanics, perhaps we shouldn't be thinking either or. Maybe the answer isn't Copenhagen or many worlds or pilot wave or anything else. Maybe instead of either or, we should think both and. Maybe we have to take a completely different and radical perspective. But that will have to wait until next time. Thanks to everyone who have asked questions about quantum mechanics. Mihail E. on email, at Charmony on Twitter, Massimiliano S. on Facebook, Isaac P. on email, at Grubelard on Twitter, Chris F. on Facebook, Akanshka B. on email, at SMTR on Twitter, Albert R. on email, Julius M. on email, Martin E. on email, John T. on Facebook, Reese C. on email, Nick S. on email, at Jordy R. Pusench on Twitter, at Pizza Larger on Twitter, Arash A. on email, HB Ariana on email, Scott M. on email, Graham D. on email, Martin N. on email, Sample Sapiens on Twitter, Peter W. on email, Mark Reap on Twitter, Sean L. on email, Susan S. on email, Daniel J. on email, Campbell D. on email, Timothy B. on YouTube, Fernando G. on email, and James W. on email. Thank you, of course, to all my top Patreon contributors. That's patreon.com/pmsutter. Top ones this month: Justin G., Chris L., Barbara K., Duncan M., Corey D., Justin Z., Andrew F., Nalia, Scott M., Rob H., Justin Lewis M., John W., Alexis, Aaron J., Jennifer M., Gilbert M., Joshua, Bob H., John S., Thomas D., Michael R., and Simon G. You can join their illustrious ranks by going to patreon.com/pmsutter. Thank you so much, everyone. Please keep sending those questions to askaspaceman@gmail.com, #askaspaceman on social, and I'm at Paul Metzutter on all social channels, askaspaceman.com for all your, well, Ask a Spaceman needs. And I will see you next time for more Complete Knowledge of Time and Space.